We hired 3,000 designers. We initially didn't hire very many researchers, and then we really turned that on. And now that's my major role, is to lead the researchers across the company. And I'm really pushing hard on really seeing that if you only did design, if you only did development, you can probably have about a 10% chance of being successful. That's actually what most of the evidence shows today. If you actually inform that design and that product development with evidence, making it evidence-based, which is really what I argue that UX research is all about, then you have a heck of a lot higher success rate. And it's also the case that I'd coined two other terms that I'm really fond of. So one of them is pseudo-design. So pseudo-design, just like pseudo-medicine and pseudo-science, is basically medicine and science without any evidence, right? You just make it up. I argue that design without research is actually pseudo-design.
Greetings from an icy cold Dublin, folks. And as always, a very warm welcome to This Is HCD, and we welcome everyone to the show, and I'm delighted to have you with us for the next 30 or 40 minutes. My name is Jerry Scullion, and I'm a designer, I'm an educator, and the host of This Is HCD, based in the wonderful city of Dublin, Ireland. Now, our goal here is to have conversations that inspire you, the practitioner, or the people interested in human-centered design, and we really want to help move the dial forward for organizations to become more human-centered in their approach to solving complex business and ultimately societal problems too. I caught up with Carl Vandenberg. Carl is currently IBM Global Vice President of Client Insights and Research and responsible for leading the company's global team of researchers and the insights they provide to product, services, and executive teams. Let me tell you a little bit about Carl. Okay, so Carl joined IBM in 1988 after having done graduate studies, research, and teaching at the University of Toronto. And he introduced user-centered design at IBM in 1993 and assumed a company-wide role in 1995, leading IBM's community of designers, leading the development of design methods, languages, and technologies, and leading the design of the commercialization of IBM Watson, something I used in the past, a fantastic API. In 2013, Carl helped found a new IBM design program together with the general manager of design at the time, Phil Gilbert, and IBM fellow, Charlie Hill. Carl personally introduced the new design program, which included enterprise design thinking, to IBM product development laboratories worldwide, and introduced a tailored version of it to the IBM consulting services and technology services organizations worldwide from 2014 through to 2016. This is really impressive. He next focused on the development and activation of enterprise design thinking for client-facing professionals worldwide and rolled that into IBM's top client accounts from 2017 to 2018. And he also conducted workshops with the C-suite and senior executives teams of hundreds of industry-leading companies worldwide, as well with startups, scale-ups, and public organizations. In this conversation, we chat about an awful lot of that stuff that I've just covered off there, such as where design needs to go in the future to be more effective. We talk about design coaching versus agile coaching, design education, and cover off some of the key insights from the work that Carl and Don Norman have done, working towards the project that they created about 3 or 4 years ago called The Future of Design Education. Carl is totally awesome, okay? And I know you're going to love this conversation, so hopefully you enjoy it. If you like what we're doing at This Is HCD, as always, folks, please help us out by leaving a review wherever you listen to the podcast. It only takes a couple of minutes, but it really helps, basically, other people find the podcast. Or you can go one better, folks, and become a patron. You can get an ad-free stream of the podcast for as little as €1.66. per month, or €20 per year, okay? And also get a shout out as a thanks. There are other plans there on the website at thisishcd.com, and literally all the money goes towards editing, hosting, and maintaining our website, which is now a repository for human-centered design goodness with over 230 episodes. Anyway, I've rambled on enough. Let's jump into this episode. Carl, delighted to welcome you to This Is HCD and the podcast. Maybe for our listeners, maybe tell us a little bit about where you're from and what you do.
Sure, Jerry, and thanks so much for inviting me. I look forward to having this conversation.
Absolutely.
So I originated in the Netherlands, and my parents actually came to North America, to Toronto, Canada. That's where I'm still based now. And my role at present is Vice President of Global Client Insights and Research at IBM.
What era are you most proud of in your IBM career to date?
Really interesting question, Jerry. So, and by the way, I was only intending to stay at IBM for a year. This was not the career I was intending. So for anybody that's listening that's like unsure about what they're doing, I've just had been incredibly fortunate. This is actually answering your question. I've been able to reinvent myself every time. I've been headhunted a lot. And each time the IBM company has supported my desire to do something different. And so I was originally hired to transform the company because at the time IBM was looking to break up into smaller companies. And the part that I was in Canada was going to be its own independent software company. And they said, man, we got to really up our focus on design and research. So that's what I took on. And then when I did that work, it then led to the top of software group saying, oh my God, we got to do this as well. And then the CEO of the whole company said, we got to do this as well. This was the user-centered design sort of phase. I think I'm very proud of that period. We really sort of upped things. But one of the things we didn't do was drive a lot of hiring of designers and researchers. And I really attribute that to a guy that came in about 10 years ago, Phil Gilbert. He was a serial entrepreneur. And he came in, and I would use the word audacious in terms of the way that he approaches things. And he would say things like, I would say, well, we need about 200 more designers. And say, did I hear 2,000? And we actually just go down the path of it. And it was evidence-based, but that was a really exciting time as well. So I think the user-centered design days were really interesting. I like the hardware days when we had the ThinkPad. We did a lot of work on that. We took the ThinkPad from 8th in customer satisfaction to number 1 in customer satisfaction. And then we sold the company to Lenovo. But yeah, there's been lots of exciting times.
I heard Phil's name mentioned when I interviewed Doug Powell a number of years ago. And he mentioned it, similar story to you, like championing design and so it's good that there was people along the way, and I know Doug's no longer at IBM, but he was a fantastic guest on the podcast. I want to take you back to 1988, okay? Because you know, it's in my era as well. Who were the challengers to IBM in 1988? It was Wang Computers, I think it was one, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think that. Well, yeah, back then you actually had green screen mainframe. Interfaces was really it. And a color display was really, really fancy. And I hearken back to, when I was in undergraduate and graduate school and I was doing any computer work, it was typically in the early days done with, the UI was basically the punch card a punch card machine, which, sounds like it's thousands of years ago, but it's not actually that long because the industry we're in just, evolves, so quickly. So I think in the early days and actually that the work that I did during my PhD program, actually I did a side gig because I was doing research on information processing, looking at affective and cognitive processing of information. And I advertised for an RA, research assistant, and all I had was male applicants. And I said, this is weird. Like 60% of the university is women. Why do I only have men? So I dug into it. It turned out it was doing work with a computer at the time. And so he said, okay, look, let's look into this. And I looked at content analysis of advertising. Yes, it was biased. We looked at the way that boys and girls in elementary school were interacting with computers. And there was like a physical moving, girls off of the computer with what the boys were doing. Then looked at the UIs, and the UIs were awful back then. They were only negative. They only would tell you when you had, when you did something wrong, and there was an error message, a sound, and a notification. So I did a project where we looked at, okay, how can we change that? How can we actually change the design of the interface? And I looked at self-report measures. I looked at galvanic skin response, heart rate, and it had an amazing result that the work that I did on the UI ended up basically eliminating the anxiety that people that had negative reactions to computers at the time. Yeah. So that's kind of what the frame was back then,
Absolutely. It's crazy because when I think back to that era, now I wasn't working in that era. I just would assume way back then in the late 80s that design and research was still relatively within the interface levels. And to have those conversations at the policy level or at the different Zoom levels, and being able to zoom out and look at the anthropology of kind of the reasoning of why things were the way they were, It sounds like IBM was quite progressive in how they accepted research, even at that stage. Is that fair to say?
No, it is. And in an actual fact, we sort of invented some of the methods, actually, that we used back then. So things like, you know, if you look at it, the earliest phase was being enamored with scientific research. So everything was doing usability studies and doing time at task. All that stuff's still done today. But back then, it was like the only thing that was done. It was end of the cycle, development cycle testing, doing all the statistics on it, which are still relevant. But there was just too much of a focus only on doing that academic sort of approach to it. And then we started to move left in the product development cycle. And I brought out user-centered design based on a book in 1989 by Don Norman and team. That was, you know, user-centered design. And I brought that around to IBM and really stood back as well and said, we need to design the entire user experience and actually create a role that had responsibility for that. And we did, you know, early interviews and we did task analyses and the like. So it really predated current design practices. But during that phase, I would say from 88 to like middle 95-ish is around the time when we really broadened the aperture.
Yeah, absolutely. So at that stage, like, for people listening who are in their 20s and 30s, they've got a glut of information at their fingertips that even when I got into the industry in the mid-2000s, we didn't have. Like, it was like I'd go into my library and I'd try and find and ask for these books, and you know, the bookshops couldn't get them and didn't have websites. At that stage, I know yourself and Don Norman were probably leading the way. This is pre-UX and this is pre- HCI probably even at that point as well. So what other people were writing about this at that stage of the journey? Can you remember?
Yeah. Well, I think Don, first of all, was a major influence. I mean, he coined HCI. He actually created that
term,
sort of discipline, you know, in computer science departments. And I think that he also coined the user experience, that term, and the like. Yeah. So he really was sort of the father of that kind of stuff, which at the time, he influenced a lot of my work. Say again?
Yeah. Bill Mogridge.
Yeah. I think all of those guys back then. But I think the ones that really informed my bent has always been on making sure that we do research and design. And I think that... And that's only now becoming more, you know, in vogue, if you will. You know, if you think about in the last sort of 15 years, there's been incredible ascendancy of design. Everybody's been, in IBM, we hired 3,000 designers. We initially didn't hire very many researchers, and then we really, you know, turned that on. And now that's my major role, is to lead the researchers across the company. And I'm really pushing hard on really seeing that if you only did design, if you only did development, you can probably have about a 10% chance of being successful. That's actually what most of the evidence shows today. If you actually inform that design and that product development with evidence, making it evidence-based, which is really what I argue that UX research is all about, then you have a heck of a lot higher success rate.
Yeah.
And it's also the case that I coined two other terms that I'm really fond of. So
it is.
And one of them is pseudo design. So pseudo design, just like pseudo medicine and pseudo science, is basically medicine and science without any evidence, right? You just make it up.
Yeah.
I argue that design without research is actually pseudo design. Yeah. And I think we shouldn't be doing that.
100%. So we both agree, and I think everyone is probably nodding their head as well. There's very few people who are cynics when it comes to the power of research and power of good research and quality research that listen to this podcast. How do we get to that point where research is a lot more available to businesses? And what's holding businesses back, do you feel? Is it a skills-based shortage, or is it an appetite or a knowledge-based shortage from the organization perspective?
I think all of the above, actually, Jerry. And I think, so I'll go through each of them. One of them is skills-based in the sense that education itself, for UX researchers. And, you know, Don Norman, in fact, that I mentioned earlier, myself founded this Future of Design Education Initiative that we've been running for the last 3 years. And that's had a focus on research education as well. And the challenge with UX research education is that there are very few schools that specifically train somebody in doing UX research sort of thoroughly. They're typically in iSchools or information schools. They get degrees in information. And while I applaud that those schools exist, I think that we need to even have way more education programs for that. And so what do we end up doing instead? We hire people from adjacent disciplines, so psychology, ethnography, anthropology. And the problem there is then you got the foundations of research, but you still don't have the UX research methods particularly either. So part of it is that we don't have the foundation. Compare that to a visual designer. You just go to any design school and you can hire a visual designer. So that's one aspect. The foundation is missing or not as strong as it could be. And the other is the bias that there's we just need to design it, or, you know, the favorite agile kind of approach of saying, you know, just fail fast, you know, and often, and say, well, you don't have to, though. You could actually do some research and actually understand what you're doing before you actually go and build something or design something. So I think there's also a lack of executive management understanding of the importance of research. Mm. And I think that's something that we need to address. And that's something at IBM, by the way, we've got a new course that we're taking all our executive team through called Client-Driven Leadership that teaches deeply this is the value of doing a proper UX research and how it should be informing. And there's often a bias too, Jerry, that where most people think that when you say UX research, you think about usability testing or, you know, evaluative research, which is fine. It's got its place. You can, you know, modify the design, you know, of a product, let's say, or the development of it. But if that's all you ever do, you're not going to really change the world. You want to be working on generative research where you're going to get those unmet needs for the enhancements to a product or even better, an entirely different product. And the other thing that my team's been working a lot on now is even go-to-market research. You can have the greatest product in the world, but if you don't design the experience of discovering it, learning about it, trying it, and then buying it, you're also not going to be successful.
You know? Absolutely. So we know that there's schools out there that are teaching research, okay? But in order for us to be really successful, we need to go the other way as well and look at the existing people who are out there in the workforce at the moment and make them aware of the power of research. So is your philosophy, does it extend to upskilling existing employees who are in adjacent fields that could be in marketing into the fields of user experience research? And if so, how do you go about it?
Yeah, and that's generally referred to as the democratization of research. And I think that that is something that has its value. And I think, but it also has its dangers because somebody just thinks, oh, I know how to do this now. I can just go do it. And so I generally guide teams to say that is it great to have designers doing some of the research work or even product managers doing it? Yeah, but under the guidance of somebody that really knows what they're talking about, a really deeply skilled leader in UX research. So yeah, I think there's a place for it. And because many people also are out there, like product managers are out there talking to clients, well, they should be using more effective methods for doing those conversations, those interviews as well, because you're going to end up with biased results, you know, if they just come back without having had any kind of appropriate, rigorous method for in doing those interviews.
Yeah. So what does a good researcher look like then in your eyes? So people can self-identify.
Yeah, really good question. My sense is that there's a number of people that can actually lift up to the level that I'm thinking of, but the kind of people that I'm thinking of, somebody that has a PhD, for example, in out of one of those schools, those iSchools, for example. Okay. Because what they have is not only the research methods, but they also have this understanding that it isn't only just academic research. I mean, it has to be practical. It needs to be lightweight enough and fast enough and focused enough to be effective in a business context. So balancing rigor with understanding of the business and how we need to move is, I think, an incredibly important skill. And then the other one is really getting to understand the domain area that you're in. There's some domain areas that are pretty easy to understand. Other ones, the ones that my researchers at IBM are working on, when you're working at enterprise kind of software and hardware, that's tougher. And so to really be effective, you need to understand that technology area as well. And then the third thing is that you need to understand how to work in an overall system, in a network of other professionals. And my favorite thing, Jerry, is that when people graduate from university at whatever level, and say they're graduating from business, they think they're the center of the universe when they get into a product team, because they understand the market. And then you have the computer science graduate, and they code the thing. You know, they're the most important, right? Designers a lot of the time from the top design schools come in and say, well, they're creating the experience. They're the most central one to this overall operation. In actual fact, as you know, you need all three of them. And if they don't, and more, you know, but unless they really can understand even the language of each other, you know, a lot of the time there's biases in the way that those disciplines, you know, bring their skills to a project. So getting rid of the biases and actually understanding the other discipline and what they can contribute. And that stuff just doesn't happen in universities.
Yeah.
You stay in your lane, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. You don't have that cross-functional kind of learning, that seedling within university where you're working across cross-disciplines. One of the things that you mentioned there a few minutes ago was the pitfalls of, you know, upskilling people who are not going to end up being world-class researchers, okay? Mm-hmm. You talk about the importance of those three groups of people being able to work alongside each other. Is one of the methods helping those other people who aren't going to be long-term researchers learn about the value of research by doing research courses? Is that one of the approaches that you'd feel works?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And then you have to do some on the job training as well, and probably shadowing of expert. And I think that even entry level researchers need to go do that be mentored by more experienced researchers. I mean, all you really have to do is sit in with a really expert researcher that's doing a structured interview, for example. You know, a junior level person is going to be like, well, here's the question I'm going to ask, and I'm going to ask this one next, and like, right? It's like doing podcast interviews, for example. If you probably have the kind of topics that you want to go through, but a really expert podcaster like you are, Jerry, you go with the flow. You go with what the person said most recently, and then, you know, sort of take it from there, rather than rigorously going through sort of a set of questions that you are going through. But you still want to cover certain topic areas, and you also want to provide appropriate support for and encouragement for the person that you're interviewing. Same thing with research. So I think that there's a certain amount of this that you can learn like book learning or video learning. And then the other one is actually doing it experientially.
I completely agree. One of the things that I see in businesses at the moment, though, is the Agile Manifesto, when it was introduced, they took to it like a duck to water. And most teams will have an Agile coach within, you know, several scrums or whatever it is. And one of the things that I believe in the next 10 years, I'd love to see is design coaches and research coaches to really help scale and provide the rigor for those teams to scale. Why is it, do you think, that Agile have been able to do this quite nicely, whereas it seems like the design industry is still lagging behind and businesses are afraid to hire external coaches?
Actually, I think that I'm not sure that I agree, in the sense that when you think about design thinking done right, and design thinking has gotten a bad name in many organizations, largely due to the fact that most organizations do it wrong. My estimate is about 80 to 90% of all design thinking is done wrong, meaning that they don't do what we call observe. They don't actually do the research first. And a lot of the time they don't do any building or making of anything. They're just doing the workshopping, right? They're reflecting. I think if you do design thinking right, and at IBM we call it enterprise design thinking, we educated like virtually everybody in the company in using these methods. And it truly was transformational. It was more transformational than Agile was, in the sense that I could talk to any executive and ask them, in our nomenclature, you know, what's a hill? What are the three hills for your project? Those are the, you know, who's going to be able to do what with what wow experience they're going to have, or who your sponsor users were. All the terminology, they knew what that was. So I think we have had that, but it clashed some of the time with Agile, and Agile, at least as done early on, it was sort of the first stage was largely starting to code. And then later on, they actually ended up creating a sprint zero, which was a planning sprint. And that's where a lot of the enterprise design thinking work, the actual user research work would happen. So the marrying of those two approaches is nirvana. It really is. And so, and early on, when we made sure that we had an Agile coach and design coach or a design thinking coach working together. And if you're, you know, any of the planning that you're doing now, it's not just looking at, okay, well, you know, what kind of coding are we going to be doing in the next sprint? It included having to take time for doing the user research work, for example, and doing the design mockups and the like. Because a lot of the time, you know, pure Agile just, you know, discounts the user and discounts design a lot of the time. And so, but marrying the two together, I think, is the ideal way of actually proceeding.
Agile seems to be driven by time and efficiency and going faster and failing faster in many of the businesses that I've coached, whereas the design coaches are like the antithesis of that. Sometimes they want to be able to challenge the time, challenge the efficiencies and say, okay, we need to slow down here. But they're so sort of attracted by this speed, the need for speed. And to quote Top Gun, wasn't imagining I was going to quote Top Gun in this episode, but the need for speed seems to be what's kind of a resistance point for design adoption for many organizations. How do you think, in three bullet points, can you answer why you think that is? But why do you feel that this is still a problem that we're facing coming into 2023? Like, it's, you know, we're 15, 20 years in, UX is quite mature in many organizations, but yet we're still getting trumped in those conversations.
Well, I think it depends on what company. So I think, you know, while IBM's not perfect, I really think that we've moved the needle on it. And I think that there's just different purposes, like you said, but you don't need to be moving slowly necessarily. So for example, the research work that you do, it needn't be part of the actual sprint schedule. You can do, like, there's certain fundamental foundational UX research work that should be done on its own schedule. So we say, okay, look, these are all the unmet needs and, we might just, so that needn't even be in the overall, you know, sprint sort of schedule, but other things when you actually schedule the design, research, and development work equally, and that's really the challenge. I think the problem is back to what I was saying earlier about the biases of different disciplines, right? So a lot of the Agile work is assuming that everything's all about development and coding. Yeah. So, well, no, if that's your bias, you're not going to have a great result. If on the other hand, you only did, like I said before, you had the bias, the design is the center of everything or research is, you're still not going to get it. And I think that the challenge is trying to get people that fundamentally are even wired differently. Like designers and coders often are very different people, right? And like anything else in society, how do you get people that are very different from one another to work together?
Yeah,
we've got that in spades all over the world right now, right? And so I think it's the human condition somewhat, that there's a challenge of trying to get people that are very different to work very closely together, and that not one of those, in this case, disciplines is the most powerful, and therefore it's driving, you know, the approaches that we use to create products, for example.
Okay. There's a whole host of areas I could go down in this conversation now, and I'm trying to keep a pretty linear path in some ways. You mentioned there way back there about the work that yourself and Don Norman have been doing around the future of design education. Research, as you're seeing, is one of the key pieces that have come out of that work. Tell us a little bit more around the output or the outcome of the 3 years of the future design education, were there other things that went alongside the research need?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And there's way, way, way more than just the research work.
Yeah. Okay.
We basically identified, well, we started off with Don and I creating a steering committee of experts. Half of them were going to be in industry or practice, as we called it. The other ones in academia. That in itself is interesting to have people working that closely together, because a lot of the time that doesn't happen. And then we asked for volunteers, and we got some 700 people volunteered to help with this project. And then we created working groups on particular themes. So we had a working group on sustainability. We had a working group on design and service design. All of these different work groups, again, we tried to make each of them half being practice, half being industry. I mean, half being practice, half being academia. And they then, you know, worked and workshopped, and we're really looking at kind of what the future of design education, what it should really look like. And then and the challenge we had, we were talking about this a little bit prior to recording, that the project actually started right around the time, almost exactly the time time that the pandemic started. And so our first face-to-face meeting was actually canceled because it was right at the beginning of the pandemic. And I think that had some impact in terms of us really working and having all those groups work well with one another. They all worked inside their own work group. And there were a few of us, Meredith Davis, who's amazing. She's now the person that's pulling together all of this stuff for publication. And I think what we did was we had, I think a total of seven different working groups, and they are all now writing their recommendations in the form of a journal article for a special issue of the Seiji Journal. And so that ought to be coming out in, I think, maybe the first or second quarter of next year. And Don and I also just wrote a final kind of summary, big picture view of where the field is going, where education is going, and that sort of thing as well.
Okay. Are you okay to talk to us a little bit more around where you think the industry is going and where the future of design education is going? Because I know there's definitely some the people from SCAD, I've had SCAD on recently as well, and we were talking a little bit more around this as well. So I'd love to get your thoughts on where you think things are going.
Yeah, from the education side, I think it's interesting that we have disruptors in education that a lot of the traditional schools aren't seeing as a disruption in design, and that is the boot camps. And so boot camps all over the place. Say again?
Yeah, like General Assembly.
Yes, exactly.
Is that what you mean by
Exactly.
Most
probably. And they're non-degree programs, basically, or alternate education. And, you know, some of them are, I think, inappropriately advertising themselves as, you can either take a four-year degree, or you can, you know, be with us for a couple of months and you get the same thing, which, you know, clearly that isn't the case. But it's also the case that, so we've hired a bunch of people from General Assembly, actually, but the most effective all of them, because a lot of the time they're not as proficient in the craft side of design or research, but they typically have a degree or two in another discipline, and typically have done work as well. So they come to, you know, when we hire them, they come with a whole package of all kinds of things that an undergraduate just straight out of, you know, a design school, you know, doesn't have. But so do those programs teach you everything you need to know? Well, no, you can't do it quite in that amount of time. But I think there's some characteristics of what those programs do that the university programs and the design schools really should take to heart, which is the sort of direct relevance of working on sort of real problems. And of course, the instructors there are typically adjunct professors and instructors that are doing day-to-day, you know, work today in an industry. But they are also really flexible in terms of their curriculum, so that each time they teach a course, they're going to, you know, modify it. But they don't have, you know, major, you know, curriculum committees to have to, you know, get approval from to make a change in a curriculum every 5 years, whether you need it or not, sort of thing. You know, I'm being a little unfair, but yeah. I think there's just a real sense of flexibility and making things relevant that I think is appropriate, you know, there. I think that universities have a huge opportunity to actually get rid of, and Don and I talk about that in our piece, get rid of this hard line between disciplines in the different schools in a university. If you actually, I always argue that as a minimum, every university should have a program like a capstone course where you have students from business, design, engineering, whatever other disciplines may be relevant, working together, you know, getting rid of those biases, all the things I said earlier.
Yeah.
And working on real problems. A lot of the time in design schools, you know, students get to do, you know, a capstone type project, but it's whatever they want to choose to do. And it might be, you know, improving the gardening in the backyard or something. It could be anything at all, right? But, and yeah. then they come to a company like ours and it's like, oh my God, these are like really hard problems to solve. Well, you should have also gotten that in university. So university. Where I see it going is, well, I don't see that going that. Where I think it should go is actually to do the very thing that companies need to do. And that is that every discipline needs to, as we talked about earlier, needs to work really effectively together. And while they may be in different, you know, units, like I have all the researchers in mind, but they can't just only work in my unit. They have to be working, you know, every single day, and they do with all the other disciplines. Same thing for the, you know, disciplines and the faculties basically in a university. I think they need to be encouraging way more of that. I always argue that it's surprising that students often only have encountered somebody from another discipline, you know, at a university party, you know, and they in their education, they may not have gotten that at all. I think that's critical to address.
Absolutely. One of the other podcasts that I run on This Is Hate City is Getting Started in Design. Mm-hmm. And I seem to have encountered an awful lot of students over the last decade that have a bumpy exit out of academia. And this sort of transition into full-time employment is quite difficult. And there seems to be this transitionary period that is quite volatile and quite traumatizing for an awful lot of people when they're trying to find that job. And one of the recent guests that I had recently just said that they were trying to learn as many skills as possible in the hope that somebody would just take a chance on them. Where do you see the role of academia extending to aid the kind of the start of a career in design? Because it seems when you look at other industries like accounting, there's there's an intake in the Big Four and they take these people in and they get started, they get these opportunities. We don't have that in design, and it's we run the risk of educating these people brilliantly, but we don't have industry there to really welcome them with open arms. And if we do, they tend to be mistreated.
Yeah. Another great question, Jerry. And I think it's a shared responsibility, quite frankly, between industry and education. When we started our design program reboot from 10 years ago, we determined that the people that we were hiring didn't have the right skills. And so we actually created a boot camp of our own. It's a 3-month boot camp. Wow. And I was quoted in the press as calling that the missing semester of design school and of university. That's how I now teach, by the way, as well. I'm an industry professor. Yeah. But that the early discussions were as a result of saying, you know, universities weren't up to snuff yet. So we hired some people from other schools, SCAD included, to teach that program. But that was way too much. You know, three months to have to invest. More of that needs to be done in the university. Now, I think that there could well be, and I've seen some really good examples of this where it's a shared responsibility that where even when somebody's coming to do like an internship, that it isn't like you're entirely now in a company doing your internship, that there may be educational opportunities still where it's a leader in the business and also a leader in the university getting together and actually reflecting on what people have learned and that sort of thing. I think it's also the case that doing more of that shared sort of education also gives students the opportunity to realize whether they really want to do this or not, you know, as opposed to now they graduated, now they got to, like, to a point that you were making, now they got to find somewhere to land. If they have a really interesting set of diverse experiences in terms of internships, and I don't mean just a really quick internship, I mean something where you could really spend some serious time and really going in depth, I think that would solve it for both. The company would understand better where the student's at, and the student could also have a better idea of what the company's all about, or what this business is all about. I mean, we've had some people recently, somebody just reached out to me on LinkedIn and said that he was in my class in 2017. And he said, you know what, I just was so thrilled to learn about design that he switched from, it was one of these multidisciplinary. I did a pan university course. Like, anybody from any discipline could come in and into my class. And he was like, he switched now from finance to design. Yeah. But you could do that if design isn't your thing. You can also switch as well. But I think right now we just hang out with only designers in design school, only developers in computer science, and we don't give students enough of an opportunity to traverse different disciplines as well.
Carl, I know we're coming towards the end of this episode, and I can't wait to get my hands on that report, okay? Is there, I know you mentioned it's going to be in Shazy magazine, I think, or the journal. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be published online?
Yeah, and you can also go to the future of designeducation.org is the website. Future of designeducation.org. You can also go to my own my own website at carlvredenburg.com, I'll update there as well. But we haven't updated the website, the Future of Design Education one, much recently, because we've been focused on this publication. But we also intend to actually publish it there.
I know the website, though. It's black and white. I remember seeing it when it was launched.
Yes.
I was watching it, and lastly, I know there's probably listeners who listen to your own podcast, Life Habits. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about where that's at. And I know you mentioned there at the start, you're going to start podcasting again.
Yeah, I actually started it when I was doing a lot of mentoring at work thought, okay, well, some of the time I'm telling the same stories. And it's like, well, why don't I record the things that I say more frequently, and then I can customize what it is that I'm doing in terms of a mentoring relationship with a particular person. So I created it inside the company, and then somebody said, why don't you go put this thing, at the time, it's like 12 years ago, why don't you put it on iTunes? And iTunes was just starting with podcasts. I said, okay, well, we'll put it there. And it quickly climbed to number one in self-help. And I thought, okay, this is kind of fun. And so so it's basically anything that is related to kind of optimizing yourself in terms of, broadly.
Nice.
I've got everything, topics from, effective public speaking, dealing with difficult people, how to inject design and research methods in improving your own life. A variety of topics, like that. And I haven't done an episode the last little while, but there's been a whole lot of interest in me doing another one. I think over the holidays, I'm going to be starting my episodes again. And if anybody has any suggestions, reach out. And
Definitely. I've listened over the years as well. And I know you're big into veganism as well. Do you want to give a shout out to your other? I know you've got a website. I found it in my notes somewhere. I want to vegan, or I can vegan. Tell us what the
I could never go vegan.com is one, and I could go vegan. It's the same website. So both your URLs take you to the same site. But I'm actually, so that's my own personal site. I would also suggest that I'm the vice president of the board of directors for a VegTO, which is basically for Toronto. That's where I'm based. A vegan organization there. And that's a pretty cool website, as well, which is veg.ca.
Okay, excellent. I'll put a link to both of those, both perspectives of veganism in the show notes for this, as well as your Life Habits podcast as well, because it's an excellent resource. But look, Carl, I always end my episodes with thanking the guest for their time and their energy and their openness and their honesty for giving me the time to have this conversation. I know everyone listening will be really appreciative of your time. So thank you so much from the bottom of my heart.
And Jerry, thank you. And being a fellow podcaster, I appreciate somebody that can do a really good interview, and you are a star. So thank you, Jerry.
Thank you so much. That's so nice coming from you. Thank you.
There you go, folks. I hope you enjoyed that episode. And if you enjoyed it and want to listen to more, why not visit thisishatecd.com, where you can learn more about what we're up to and also explore our courses whilst you're there. Thanks again for listening.